credits to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Today, epic fail.
I've got the will to fail. The will to fail. I have talents that I never use. I try to win, but I love to lose because I've got the will to fail.
Ever tried, ever failed, no matter. Try again, fail again, fail better.
There are better failures than others, and...
Learn from failure, friends. It never gives up. It always wins in the end.
And that's epic fail, no matter how I spin it. Epic fail from ending the beginning. One step forward, two steps back. On a one-way track, as a matter of fact.
Thank God for failure. Couldn't do so much of my life. It's all I ever knew. Thank you for failure in MIT music, for making the dreams that chose me come true.
But there are things that failure teaches that nothing else can.
Failure. We're taught from kindergarten on to avoid it. But in fact, failure just might be the surest path to success. Today, studies in failure. A frustrated academic finds success in the unlikeliest place, on Twitter. And the story of a movie that failed so badly it was never even made, but still managed to influence an entire generation of other Hollywood films. First, what could possibly be good about failure? Sarah Lewis is an art curator, a critic at the Yale School of Art, and a member of President Obama's Arts Policy Committee. She's also the author of The Rise: Creativity, the Gift of Failure, and the Search for Mastery.
Creativity and path-breaking human endeavor is a mystery, but you really do come closer to it when you start to understand the gifts of not just failure, but setbacks and obstacles. I came to it organically because I myself had failed and had learned a lot from it as a teenager. But when I went into the arts, I would see these backturned paintings in artist studios and saw that they didn't want to show me those paintings, but they did really help them create what it was that they were very proud of. And I thought that it would be just important to make sure that we had this conversation in public about the nature of this gift of failure.
Why do you call it a gift?
There's so many advantages that come from this process. I think we often, and we all should, want to be accomplished and have a certain level of achievement. But there are things that failure teaches that nothing else can. And that's really in part why the word gift is so important to me when thinking about this topic.
Hmm. And you went to Harvard, a place that has historically been so averse to failure. I've heard it said that it's virtually impossible to flunk out. So you know what it's like to be on a success track. But near the beginning of your book, you write that even as a teenager, you were beginning to live with the gift of what it means to be underestimated. What do you mean?
You're right about Harvard, to a certain extent. Although I should say Harvard created the Success Failure Project very recently.
What's that?
It's a place where various individuals from the Dean of Harvard College Admissions, who himself was expelled from high school, actually, and learned a great deal about resilience, something he looks for in Harvard applicants. He himself will speak on a panel with various others through the Success Failure Project to make sure that we're all looking at what gifts do come from adversity. It's a really holistic way of looking at human endeavor.
Though I'm sorry, there's something so amusing about it. But of course, students who go to Harvard have to be taught how to fail.
Well, you know, Drew Faust, the president of Harvard, has said, that's right, Harvard students are very used to being successful. Being seen as a failure, it goes against your understanding of yourself, so you do need some support. But I think it's important to feel as if you're in lineage. When you look at the lives of so many individuals, Martin Luther King to J.K. Rowling, Oprah, you start to understand that we really do need to master this. It's the one thing we're never really taught.
Hmm.
Being underestimated, though, for me personally, did propel me on this journey. I think it's a unique experience when someone looks at you because of maybe your youth or your gender or your race. And without even opening my mouth, I know that I might be seen as a failure to meet a kind of standard in some people's minds. So it was a very kind of subconscious idea, thinking about the gift of being underestimated, but it certainly made me want to see how others had taken uncommon foundations and found in them strengths to have their own rise.
One of the things that's kind of comforting about reading your book is discovering how many people have created what we consider masterpieces, you know, in writing or art or science, who actually considered their own work to be deeply flawed or even failure in some way or another. You write about Faulkner, for instance, who wrote The Sound and the Fury, never really thought it was done.
Isn't that incredible? He didn't. After he published it and went on to achieve its iconic status, he felt that it was a near win, something I talk about a lot in The Rise. He published subsequent editions, different parts of the book he wanted to improve, as an appendix 16 years later. He had an experience that many masters do, which is that there's a sense of incompletion in their project. Another example would be Paul Cézanne, who signed just under 10% of his paintings because he thought that the rest of the 90% were really incomplete. They didn't really meet his goal.
Wow.
Of course, yeah. It's just amazing.
So what do you mean when you talk about a near win?
The near win, coming close to your goal but not meeting it. In athletic competition, it's an Olympic silver medalist or bronze medalist, for example, sometimes gives you propulsion that you never would have had if you actually met your goal, and through it can find kind of groundbreaking endeavors and achievements. There's an interesting study that came out of Cornell. There was a study about these Olympic silver medalists versus bronze medalists, and the researchers found that the frustration that the silver medalist had compared to bronze medalist being happy to just not have received fourth place, made silver medalist really focus on follow-up competition in a way that bronze medalist did not. And that we see in many different athletic achievements from a Jackie Joyner Kersee or a Julie Moss, whose near win popularized Ironman competitions. So the sense of the near win, I think, is a really interesting way to look at the kind of propulsion that we need to live in a way that focuses on not just success, but mastery, as I see it, this sort of journey of ever onward almosts that over a course of a lifetime can result in really iconic achievements.
But that's really fascinating because one of the things you're saying is it's not just any old failure you need. There are good failures and even better failures in terms of their ability to motivate.
I love the way you put that. That's right. There are better failures than others, and coming close is one of them. We all experience this sort of gradation of failures in life. One of the ways of thinking about why the near win is so impactful is to imagine this sort of scenario. Say you're going to the airport, and you get there 5 minutes late, and you miss your flight. Compare that to the way you'd feel if you missed the flight by 30 minutes. If you miss it by 5 minutes,
that's a lot worse.
Right. It feels much worse. So that's the same phenomenon that's going on with these athletes and inventors and artists and entrepreneurs.
That makes me think of the Silicon Valley mantra, fail better.
Mm-hmm.
You write about there's a whole Silicon Valley conference, or at least it started in the Silicon Valley, called FailCon.
That's right. FailCon is a place where entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley, and now around the world, there are many of them, go and can only speak about their failures. And we're not just talking about any entrepreneur. We're talking about entrepreneurs who have achieved incredible levels of quote-unquote success, from Travis Kalanick, who founded Uber, to Vinod Khosla. And I went there. I had been steeped in stories of failure to triumph for about 2 years, interviewed over 150 individuals for The Rise. But I was still so surprised by how forthcoming people were on the stage there at FailCon. FailCon is an annual conference, about 500 individuals, keynote speeches. But there's a level of vulnerability that comes when you can only speak about your failure, when you can't couch it in a sort of neatly packaged story. The idea that you have to take a risk, that you have to be willing to fail in order to innovate, is so critical that it's important to have a safe space in order to speak about these stories.
The thing is, we all know this, right? I mean, we've all grown up hearing famous quotations like Edison's famous line, "I haven't failed, I've just found 10,000 ways that won't work." Mm-hmm. You know, we've all heard that geniuses aren't people who succeed more often, they're just people who have failed more often. You know, the problem is that nobody actually wants to fail.
Exactly. We were talking about the Harvard Success Failure Project earlier. A woman who runs it, Abigail Lipsum, said to me, "Sarah, when you write this book, I just want to make sure you get this point across, that in order to benefit from failure, you do have to first let yourself feel pretty badly about it," she said. And she's right. I think that's in large part why we do know this, that failure can be an advantage, but we don't want to live it out, of course, because you have to go to a difficult place in order to get the sort of jewels that come from it. But then there's some stories you mentioned, you know, Edison. I was thinking about Fred Astaire, such an icon of dance, and his RKO screen test in the 1930s was can't sing, can't act, can dance a little, balding. You know? Ouch. And you just think it happens to everyone.
Yeah. You know? What is it we have to do in order to embrace failure? Because as you said, you know, it feels crappy.
Mm-hmm. There are a number of techniques I've seen now that people use. I'll give you a few examples. One is to give yourself some distance from the experience. Angela Duckworth, who focuses on grit down at the University of Pennsylvania, she has told me that if she receives, say, a rejection from a grant, she'll put it in a folder and give herself some time away from it and then come back to it so that she can extract the gains that come from information, really. And that is what failure is. It's information. But some of the difficulty is when we have such pain about it that we just can't see it. Twyla Tharp, for example, she would often have someone read critique to her so that they could kind of take the poison out of it and deliver the information.
So you also interviewed a British explorer, Ben Saunders. He's a polar explorer. What did you learn about failure from him?
This is fascinating. Ben is someone who you would think has a sort of superhuman ability in him. He has been the third person in the world ever to go to the North Pole solo and on foot, and now the first person in the world to go to the South Pole and back from the rim of Antarctica. What I learned from him was the importance of surrender as a way of finding strength in difficult endeavor. Surrender, for most people, means giving up. But when he was in the Arctic, for example, and he was in sub-50 degree Celsius temperatures and feeling that all of his attempts over 12 hours to go forward were being erased because the ice sheets are moving backwards, which often happened, that there was nothing more that he could do but surrender to the fact of this harsh environment, to not resist it, to not fight it, and in that process to maintain this sort of access to the internal resources that he needed to keep moving forward. Now, I mean, surrender is something, a metaphor for it is sort of the martial art of Aikido, which Bruce Lee called the most perfect art. It's the martial art with no kicks in it. It's just about absorbing the energy from an attack and redirecting that energy into the ground, finding a way to sort of get kicked but rise up stronger. And I think surrender has a really important place in all of our lives when it comes to transforming so-called failure into triumph.
Well, that's really interesting because one of the things that we often say about failure, I think, is we focus on how important it is to get up. Think of Rocky, the image of the hero or the would-be hero who's just going to, no matter what happens, is just going to come back fighting. Surrender is a really different image, right? Surrender implies just giving up. I sense that there's a subtle difference there, but one that you think is really important.
Absolutely. It is important to have grit and to keep going. It is important to be a Rocky, but there is this paradox in life that oftentimes it's actually that moment that you surrender that you find your greatest strength and sometimes a new path. Maybe the most vivid example of this, beyond Ben Saunders, and I think he's the classic one, is a timeless example, and that's Samuel F.B. Morse, who invented the telegraph. But he spent 26 years in what he thought was the failed pursuit of being not just a painter, but a painter of real renown. He wanted to be kind of a Michelangelo, a Titian. And at this moment, after 26 years, where he couldn't support his family, himself, he wasn't getting the acclaim he wanted, and he was failing in any attempt to get a commission from Congress to paint there, he converted the stretcher bars of the canvas itself into the telegraph and surrendered himself to the fact that there was this interest in being an inventor in him and pursued that path.
Sarah Lewis is the author of The Rise: Creativity, the Gift of Failure, and the Search for Mastery. Coming up, a professor tweets his frustration with academic life and becomes a star on Twitter. Also, the story of the failed film that changed Hollywood science fiction forever. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. If you spend much time on Twitter, you might have come across Nine Quarterly. That's nine as in German for no. It's the creation of Eric Jarosinski, a self-described failed intellectual who tweets bitter, sardonic little comments. Things like, "We'll know art is dead once people stop saying it is." To his complete surprise, he's amassed 75,000 followers. Steve Paulson sat down with him.
Eric, take me back to January 2012. You're working as an assistant professor of German at the University of Pennsylvania. You're struggling to write a book. What's going on at that moment in your life?
Let's see. As soon as I put myself back there, I get a little tense, to be honest. I find myself sitting in my study at my laptop, kind of frozen in front of text that I've been writing for the last 5 or 6 years, I suppose, at that point, a book. Academic tome that I was required to write for a chance at tenure at a research university, as anyone who knows that system is familiar with. There's a lot of publication required. And I've been doing okay up to that point, and I really just got tired of doing this project, frustrated with it. I don't exactly know how to explain it, but it just wasn't working. And one of my main frustrations, I think, was with the language of academia, that I couldn't really find a way to express myself that was both proper to the subject and the context, and felt like it was my own somehow. And I happened to become acquainted with Twitter by chance at that point and didn't know much about it and had never spent much time on the internet before or social media. I kind of fell in love with it.
So instead of writing the book that was going to get you tenure, you were procrastinating by starting to tweet.
You could say that. It's funny because in a way, this was in fact seeking some refuge from a larger project that was causing me such frustration. But at the same time, it's actually pretty closely related to it. I was writing short texts, the likes of which I'd been reading for the last several years. My favorite philosophical texts are aphoristic texts by Nietzsche, by Theodor V. Adorno, others. And this to me seemed like a way that I could experiment with that myself.
What's fascinating is, I mean, it sounded like you had run up against writer's block, you know, writing this big academic book, but suddenly it unleashed your creativity on Twitter.
Yeah, I think that's pretty fair to say. I'd also found that in teaching in a lot of ways, the performative aspect, the kind of thinking on your feet aspect of being in front of a class. And there was something like that in Twitter as well. But yeah, I would say a lot of the frustration turned into writing about frustration, probably more than anything else.
So why was tweeting so much easier than writing academically?
I'm still trying to figure that out myself, but I think that it had to do with the fact that I was playing more of a character, I suppose, on Twitter. The persona that I've developed more than anything is based on this philosopher Adorno, who I've spent so much time with, but also he's become very much my own version of him.
This is Theodor Adorno, the German philosopher and cultural critic.
Yeah, and mainly known for his work on the culture industry and often sort of lampooned for a great dislike, if not disgust, with popular culture. Yet at the same time, someone who took it very seriously and who gave us much of the vocabulary that we use to talk about popular culture today. And someone who spent time in America in exile during World War II. And so to me, also an interesting cultural bridge, really, between the U.S. and Germany, Europe in general. So I think that for me, this became a figure who was all about kind of a ridiculous degree of self-confidence in his pronouncements about the world. So it gave me license really to say whatever I wanted to say. The funny thing is, though, is that over time, I think that persona that I had developed at the beginning is becoming more like me, or I'm becoming more like the persona. But this is something that I've noticed since I began.
So this Twitter account, it's called Nine Quarterly. Tell me about it. I mean, what is this persona that you've developed?
Well, it's a voice, really, more than anything. I mean, it has the name Nine Quarterly because it is to have sort of the rarefied air of an academic journal of some sort, one that doesn't exist, at least not yet. This notion of nine, or of course German for no, is what a lot of this is about for me. I mean, I call this a compendium of utopian negation.
Utopian negation.
Yes, in the wonderful kind of at least double sense of that, and that of saying no to something that might present itself as utopian but isn't, but also saying no as a type of utopian project, that there's something more than what we have now. There could be something else, possibly something better, more likely just wrong in different ways. But there's the potential for something else, and that's what this is about.
So you've created these very witty, funny tweets. Just a couple of examples. At Starbucks, I order under the name Godot, then leave.
Did I write that?
You did write that, yes. And another great one, Nietzsche said there'd be eternal recurrences like this. You know, it sort of kind of makes you have to think about somebody. You know, it's, I mean, very short, but there's a little kind of philosophical sting there.
Yeah, that is very much the idea. I think of it as writing jokes or sort of a tradition of the one-liner. It's interesting because this is caught on probably most and earliest on about a year ago in Germany. I think in a way what I've done is sort of maybe taken a style of humor that even came from Europe at some point, developed in the United States into a certain tradition. One of my favorite things to do are write someone walks into a bar jokes. These things do well in Europe and Germany in particular. And I think that something that they're finding there that maybe hasn't existed is a sense of criticism that is also, in a way, well-meaning somehow, or isn't simply snide or isn't simply sarcastic, a critical voice that's also willing to make fun of itself. That's very much who I think of myself as being. And I think that that's a lot of kind of how this failure is translated into something else, of frustration being expressed, but also frustration with myself, frustration with my context, etc.
So the persona that you've developed, it's kind of pessimistic, a little bit whimsical, but also you're a bit of a misanthrope, right?
Yes, I would say, depending on the day, a more or less lovable misanthrope. I think my persona at one point said that the misanthrope is the last true people person. My disgust is universal and democratic, and I guess I'd like to keep it that way.
So I have to ask, what makes a good tweet?
It depends on what you're trying to accomplish with it. I think, as in any type of comedy, you're working with a type of surprise reaction, type of getting someone going one way and then quickly move to another. That small explosion of the joy of contradiction, that's the heart of any joke. What that translates into in writing, for me, at least in this Twitter format, in which things are passing you by very quickly and without any context. It's simply one joke is going to show up in a stream of world events about one tragedy after another, or your aunt's cat, or whatever it happens to be. It has to be completely self-contained, and it has to have a rhythm that works for that speed. And if anything, I've started to think about how a tweet sounds more than anything, so that if I go back to my original material of a couple of years ago, I could never write it the same way now. Now, whatever I've written would become half the size that it was then. And probably the punctuation would be radically different than it was then.
So do you have favorite tweets that you've done for Nine Quarterly?
I guess one that I liked was simply, signifying nothing is harder than it looks.
Tell me what you've written in the last day or two.
I tried to write something on the topic of failure on my way over here, on the topic of the show. What was it? But I never read these out loud. This is going to be a first. Learn from failure, friends. It never gives up and always wins in the end. That was one on the way over. But see, it doesn't work with my voice because that's not the voice I write them in.
So give me the voice that if you can, you know, I don't know, put on your Adorno accent.
It's much more
Germanic.
It's sort of, learn from failure, friends. It never gives up. It's always wins in the end.
There you go. It's just you've totally changed it. Yes.
The one I wrote today was a classic, which was simply Another Beautiful Day to Die in Venice. Let's see. Another weekend wasted on the utopian potential of social media. Sorry. It's funny. I have sort of an evil laugh when I read these.
So I want to follow up on one of those tweets, learning from failure. I mean, do you believe this? Is failure in some weird way an educational tool, perhaps even a path to success?
Perhaps. I think for me, at least, there might be something to that. I'm not so sure about the path to success part as much as I would say it's a way of stepping outside of a context that you found yourself in and some rules that you had accepted and some standards you had accepted, some measures of success that you'd accepted, and making yourself question what it is that you actually want to do, what you actually want to succeed in. If success, as it's officially defined in whatever context you're in, job, relationship, whatever, if that actually is something you would consider a success.
Well, Eric, I wish you all the success in the world, if that is in fact what you are after.
Thank you. If not that, then at least failing in some other more interesting way.
Eric Jarosinski is the brain behind the Twitter account 9Quarterly. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Remember the famous lightsaber battles in the Star Wars? They've inspired generations of 9-year-olds, but those scenes might never have been made if it hadn't been for the failure of another film. Frank Povich tells the story in a new documentary called Jodorowsky's Dune. It chronicles filmmaker Alejandro Jodorowsky's failed quest to make what could have been one of the greatest science fiction movies ever. Doug Gordon talks with Povich.
Frank, why did you decide to make a documentary about a film that was never made?
Because it's not just a film that was never made. This is the greatest film never made. And this is also the most influential film never made. And both those statements sound kind of insane, but I believe them in my heart to be completely true.
Why do you believe this to be the greatest film never made?
It's also the most fully realized film that was never realized. It really comes down to the whole story behind it, to this man, Alejandro Jodorowsky, and the previous films that he had made, most notably El Topo and the Holy Mountain. And then he tried to do his big screen adaptation of a giant science fiction novel called Dune. And the whole film is done. The whole film is done on paper. From the first scene to the last scene, there's over 3,000 images, and every vehicle has been drawn out, and spaceships, and clothing, and everything is truly done. And it was just so incredibly adventurous. It was just such a high level of creativity.
So how did Jodorowsky go from El Topo and the follow-up film, The Holy Mountain, to becoming interested in turning Frank Herbert's 1965 epic science fiction novel, Dune, into a film?
He said it came to him as a divine inspiration. When he was asked by his producer, what do you want to do? He said, Dune. And at that point, he had not read the novel.
I didn't read Dune, but I have a friend who said it was fantastic. I don't know what I say Dune. I can say Don Quixote, or I can say Hamlet. I don't know anything. I say Dune.
And that was just the first of his many divine inspirations, as he would say.
What do you think attracted him to Dune?
I don't know. The lights from the heavens. I don't know. I wonder how much sway this person who told him it was good had on him.
Yeah, obviously a lot, I'm thinking.
He really didn't know much about it, but if you read Dune, it's kind of right up his alley.
Dune is this sprawling space epic that focuses on the planet Arrakis, a desert planet where this spice, melange, is found. This consciousness-expanding drug, which is one of the most important commodities in the entire universe.
This makes Dune into a planet of extraordinary strategic importance, almost, I guess, the galactic version of Afghanistan.
Paul Atreides is a young noble. Paul gets cast out of his house and leads a revolution of the Fremen, the local natives on Arrakis, to take over the planet from the evil colonial Harkonnens who are controlling it, and to sort of return power of the spice to the people.
At one point in your documentary, Jodorowsky says that when you make a picture, you must not respect the novel. And he goes on to say,
I was raping Frank Herbert, you know, raping like this, but with love, with love.
He was really looking at the book as literature, not as a manual. He was not looking to do a page-to-screen adaptation.
What did he want to achieve by making Dune? For him, this wasn't just making a film, was it?
No, as he says in the film, he wanted this film to be a prophet.
I want to create a prophet to change the young mind of all the world. For me, Dune will be the coming of a god, artistical, cinematographical god.
He says the worst thing in the world is for somebody to walk into a movie theater and to come out 2 hours later unchanged, to be the same person. He wants you to have a shock when you see his film and to change your life and to see everything in a completely different way. He says that's the goal of art, is to be transformative.
The way he speaks about making the film with such religious fervor, it's almost as if he's using the film as a way of elevating the audience's consciousness in the same way that the characters in Dune use melange to kind of elevate their consciousness.
I think so. He says,
que diera a la gente que tomaba LSD en
he esa wanted
época,
to make a film that would create the hallucinations that people have when they take LSD, but without taking LSD. So he basically wanted people to go into the theater and have a sort of hallucinogenic, psychedelic experience brought on just by his film. When I see his older films, when I see The Holy Mountain or El Topo, no matter how many times I see it, I'm changed. I see new things and I think the world differently. His work is really the most powerful films that I've ever witnessed.
Yeah. He also wanted to get Salvador Dali and Orson Welles involved, didn't he?
He did. He had Salvador Dali attached to be in the film. He had Orson Welles attached. He had David Carradine. Jodorowsky's own 12-year-old son, Brontis, was set to star. He had Pink Floyd, who was going to do the music. I mean, this truly would have been an incredible, incredible film.
Yeah. How did the negotiations with Dali go?
The negotiations with Dali were probably Jodorowsky's most challenging part. As he says, he had to seduce Dali. He basically had to chase him all over the world. He first met him in New York, and then he had to go to Barcelona, and then he had to go to Paris, and then he had to go back to Spain, and he kept chasing him each time, trying to convince him that you are the only person in the world who can play the mad emperor of the universe. And really, who is better to play the mad emperor of the universe?
Absolutely. He was already playing that part, pretty much.
in his normal life.
Yeah, exactly. Dali wanted to make a lot of money out of doing this, so they had to reach a kind of compromise.
Dali wanted to be the highest paid actor in Hollywood. That was his dream.
I will work with you, but I want to be the actor más pagado de Hollywood. Quiero 100 mil dólares la hora.
So he was demanding $100,000 an hour to be in the film, which is a rate that it's impossible, especially in 1970s dollars. And they kind of renegotiated and they came back and they figured out that he would be in the film for somewhere between 3 to 5 minutes of actual screen time. So they went back to him and they said, okay, we will pay you $100,000 per used minute on screen, which would end up being less money, but it allowed Dali to say that he is the $100,000 per minute actor.
Yeah.
Which is really the greatest thing in his mind ever.
Yeah. What do you think, if he had been able to make his version of Dune, if the suits, the Hollywood executives could have kept up with him and his ideas, how do you think it would have been received?
I mean, that's the interesting question. There's different timelines, I think, in the universe. And depending on what you choose today, that timeline changes. We are on the timeline where Jodorowsky's Dune was not completed. But there's another timeline, I think, that exists where his film was completed. And even there, that timeline can split. And let's say his film was completed and was a success. Let's imagine that it was the greatest, biggest movie ever, and everybody went to go see it 10 times, and there was lines around the block. What would that have proved to the studios? You know, that would have proved to them that bizarre, avant-garde, European-style science fiction films are viable and will make money. So maybe the big tentpole films every year that the studios come out with would be more avant-garde, more artistic, less comic book.
I want to get on that timeline.
Kind of interesting. But then also, I mean, let's say his Dune had been created and been a failure. Let's say it had been a disaster. Let's say it took down a studio. It was such a financial disaster. Then Fox, who had Star Wars in the pipeline, they would have used that as their first excuse to just pull that plug, and the world would not have Star Wars. And again, for better or for worse, a world without Star Wars, where are you? What are the big films every year? What are those big science fiction films? We probably wouldn't have these superhero films. We wouldn't have the Avengers coming out. It would be a very different landscape. Maybe it would be costume dramas of the turn of the century. It would be something very, very different than where we're living right now.
Yeah. In 1984, David Lynch's version of Dune was released. Did Jodorowsky ever see it?
He did. Against his will, it was a very painful time, I think, because, you know, he could not realize his Dune. But then one of his favorite directors, David Lynch, somebody cut very much from the same surrealistic cloth of Alejandro Jodorowsky, gets to tell the story. And what could be more painful than that? He thought, if anyone could make this movie, it would be this guy. And he did not want to go see it. He was terrified to go see it. And his sons kind of had to force him to go. And they said, okay, now it's playing here, and we are warriors. We need to go together to see this film, for better or for worse. We need to face this monster. So they took him to the theater. They basically dragged him there. He said he was almost crying. Okay. He just really could not handle that this was reality. And he said, as he was watching the film,
step by step, I became happy because the picture was awful. It's a failure. Well, it's a human reaction, no? Because, oh, yeah, it's not beautiful, but I have that reaction. Yeah, I say it's not possible. It's not David Lynch, because he is a big artist. He's the producer who did that.
Near the end of your film, Jodorowsky says that for him to fail is only to change the way. And I'm curious if you think the fact that Jodorowsky was not able to make Dune, should we see that as a failure?
No, I don't think so. He truly believes in his heart that he made the film. In the documentary, when he speaks about drawing the storyboards, he doesn't say drawing. He says shooting. He says, we were shooting the picture. We were shooting, and that Mobius was my camera. He really believes that the film was created.
If you fail, it's not important. No? We need to try.
Frank Pavich is the director of the documentary Jodorowsky's Dune. He talked with Doug Gordon. And that's it for our conversation about failure. Coming up, saying goodbye to Jon Stewart after 16 years of political humor on The Daily Show and a dangerous idea. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
You are about to experience a totally new dimension and
ideas. The intellectual thrill ride of the year. To the Best of Our Knowledge proudly presents
Dangerous
Ideas.
Hi, I'm Sam Chris and I'm a writer. My dangerous idea is in the form of a book review. The newly published DSM is a classic dystopian novel. It's also not exactly a conventional novel. Its full title is an unwieldy mouthful, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, 5th edition. The thing itself is on the cumbersome side. Over 2 inches thick and with 1,000 pages, it's unlikely to find its way to many beaches. Not that this should deter anyone. Within is a brilliantly realized satire that turns luridly absurd, chillingly perceptive, and profoundly disturbing. The idea emerges that every person's illness is somehow their own fault, that it comes from nowhere but themselves, their genes, their addictions, and their inherent human insufficiency. We enter a strange shadow world, where for someone to engage in prostitution isn't the result of intersecting environmental factors, gender relations, economic class, family and social relationships, but a symptom of conduct disorder, along with lying, truancy, and running away. A mad person is like a faulty machine. DSM-5 seems to have no definition of happiness other than the absence of suffering. The normal individual in this book is tranquilized and bovine-eyed, mutely accepting everything in a sometimes painful world without ever feeling much in the way of anything about it. The vast, absurd excesses of passion that form the raw matter of art, literature, love, and humanity are too distressing. It's easier to stop being human altogether, to simply plod on as a heaped collection of diagnoses with a body vaguely attached. For all the subtlety of its characterization, the book doesn't just provide a chilling psychological portrait. It conjures up an entire world. The clue is in the name. On some level, we're to imagine that the American Psychiatric Association is a body with real powers, that the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual is something that might actually be used, and that its caricature of our inner lives could have serious consequences. Sections, like those on the personality disorders, offer a terrifying glimpse of a futuristic system of repression, one in which deviance isn't furiously stamped out like it is in Orwell's unsubtle Oceania, but pathologized instead. Here, there's no need for any rats, and the diagnostician can honestly believe that she's doing the right thing. It's all in the name of restoring the sick to health. DSM-5 describes a nightmare society in which human beings are individuated, sick, and alone. For much of the novel, what the narrator of the story is describing is its own solitude, its own inability to appreciate other people, and its own overpowering desire for death. But the real horror lies in the world that could produce such a voice.
That's Sam Criss with his Dangerous Idea, and you can find more Dangerous Ideas on our website at ttbook.org. Speaking of Dangerous Ideas, Jon Stewart recently announced that he's stepping down from his role as host of The Daily Show. It's kind of hard to imagine the upcoming political season without him. So let's take a little trip back in time to 2004. John Kerry is running against George W. Bush, and Steve Paulson calls Jon Stewart.
For starters, because we're on the phone and I can't see you, I have to ask you a basic question.
Yes, pink dress with a tiara. I'm assuming the question is, what are you wearing?
Exactly, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, now that we have that out of the way, you have been, of course, following this presidential campaign very closely, and I think it's fair to say that the candidates have been trying to counteract various negative stereotypes for Kerry. He's said to be aloof and boring and unfocused.
Oh, I hadn't heard any of this.
Oh, of course, yeah. Have the debates so far changed these perceptions?
Absolutely. They've been freewheeling, spontaneous. I've been stunned at the sort of lack of caution that has been displayed in these debates. I mean, two men standing in the center of the ring, toe-to-toe, pouring out their hearts to the American people. It has been, wait a minute, these presidential debates?
These presidential debates.
Oh, yeah, no, those have been bad. I'm sorry. Thinking of Lincoln Douglas.
Of course, the main criticism of his presidency is that President Bush has botched the war on Iraq. Have the debates shed any light on this?
See, I think botching a war, you know, that's got to be right up there with, you know, your health policy tends to favor the drug companies. You know, I think that's a pretty good, if you're trying to go for a criticism, that's a pretty sharp one to throw out there.
So how should we decide whether the war is going well or not? What are the criteria for success?
One of them is a lack of explosions, I've always found. And again, I am not a military historian or scientist, but I have always thought that one of the real telltale signs of a war being over is a lack of concussive action, a lack of shrapnel. And from what I can see, and again, this is coming from a fake news organization, but on the TV, it appears that there are very large, spontaneous, I perhaps call them combustion events, that tend to lean one in the direction that perhaps the mission may have been accomplished, and people are still perhaps celebrating with fireworks. I don't exactly know what's going on over there.
Now, one thing I've been wondering about, especially sort of trying to square a couple of things, you know, the values debate, the questions about taxes and all of that, is if you're a gay man who makes $500,000, who should you vote for?
Is this a rhetorical one again?
I leave that to you to judge.
All right.
Who should you vote for?
You're a gay man.
Who makes $500,000 a year.
Oh, that's an excellent question. You should vote for neither candidate, because neither candidate is particularly I would think. Now, that I'm not sure what would go along with that. So you're suggesting that the Republicans are not as gay-friendly?
Perhaps.
Yeah. And that the Democrats are not as friendly to $500,000?
Perhaps, yes.
It's an excellent question. My guess is it really wouldn't matter. If you make $500,000, it really doesn't matter whether you're gay or straight. That buys a certain amount of privacy.
So if you have that much money, you basically you don't even need to bother to vote.
Who's in the White House? And for the most part, for most people's lives that are doing well, who the president is not really the issue. The president truly matters to those on the, either the fringes or directly involved in policies that are more day-to-day, like the military, poor people, old people, people who love people, people who need people, I just got lost in something here. People. But in general, if you're making $500,000 a year, you know, Mr. T could be president, and your life's still going to be pretty good.
Now, as far as I know, you yourself do not call yourself a Republican or a Democrat. What is your take on the two-party system?
I think it perfectly reflects the bichromatic prism that is human thought. As we know, human thought is really only possible in one of two ways. And so it, I think, is a perfect reflection of the simplicity and lack of, I don't want to say nuance, but lack of flexibility of human thought.
Bichromatic?
Yes. Black and white.
Ah, okay.
Or perhaps, to put another way, I'm glad that we have fewer choices politically than we have in soft drinks.
Well, thank you very much. This has been very enlightening.
That is the nicest thing anybody has said to me when I've been rambling in this manner. I thank you for not saying, by the way, why did you waste my half hour?
Thank you, and it sounds like you've got a show to put together.
We do indeed, and hopefully tonight it'll be a decent one.
Okay, good. Thanks.
Very cool. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, bye-bye. Bye-bye.
That's John Stewart talking with Steve Paulson in a conversation from 2004. Stewart hasn't announced what he's going to do after he leaves The Daily Show later this year. What do you do when you're tired of making jokes about presidents? Well, how about writing jokes for presidents? Seriously, presidential joke writer? That's actually a thing. We know because Jim Fleming talked with the guy who used to write jokes for the Clinton White House. Mark Katz told him about helping Bill Clinton learn to embrace the art of self-deprecation.
In January of 1995, he gave a State of the Union address that was very long, hour and a half long. He looked over his shoulder. Even Al Gore was nodding off. But he was trying to do something. You know, this was just a few months after Newt Gingrich in the 105th Congress. He was basically trying to steal back his own agenda. So he'd put together such an ambitious speech that it went on for an hour and a half. And he was getting grief for that. And that felt like yet another missed opportunity in what was becoming, you know, a missed opportunity of a presidency. At that moment in time, he seemed like he was limping towards one term. So I, that very week, was the Alfalfa Club. He gave the State of the Union on Tuesday. The Alfalfa was Saturday night. By Wednesday, around noon, I came up with the idea that he should walk to the podium of this room where 300 of the most important people in Washington are sitting there waiting to hear from the president.
And not just 300 of the most important people, but 300 people he really didn't like.
That's right. Well, the Alfalfa Club is more corporate. It's actually not a press dinner. It's kind of a more of a corporate dinner. And he didn't have warm feelings for the constituents of that particular club. So he wasn't especially happy about going.
So he wasn't fired with a desire to make them laugh.
Or please them or win them over. And the idea that I had was he would walk to the podium, pull an egg timer from his pocket, set it to 5 minutes, and put it on the corner of the podium, which only set up, one, get that laugh, you know, a self-directed laugh, and two, set up a better joke to come, which is at the end of 5 minutes, keep on adding time to the timer for as many times as he wants. It was a big laugh each time, or so I imagined. Except that in the half hour before he was about to give the speech, we were going to go over it for the very first time. And he walked into a holding room in the Capitol Hilton, and the first words he said to me that night was, "You can put that egg timer away." He was not happy with the premise of it, wasn't happy to concede what it conceded. didn't care for it one bit. And
he felt that that long speech was a valuable speech full of good ideas and people shouldn't be making fun of it.
And by the way, he got a lot of applause in that speech. Why should that be held against him, you know? So, no, he didn't want to concede the point and didn't want to do that joke. And it was a tense, angry meeting. Oddly angry for, you know, a humor writer in a room with him. And as I tried to kind of convince him of what had yet been self-evident to him, he walked out of the room. And I thought I wrote the last speech I was ever going to write for him. And I found the courage. I gave the egg timer to an advance aide and said, the president's going to need this up on the podium, even though I knew how strongly he had vetoed the idea. Because honestly, I didn't know what speech he was going to give. And figuring it was
without
my last
speech. Without the egg timer, half the jokes were gone.
It was the organizing principle of the speech. So as it turned out, he was up there rewriting the speech during most of the dinner and got up and gave the speech he wrote on the dais. And it didn't go over very well. It was meaner than it needed to be. It was less self-gracious, certainly not self-effacing. In fact, some people wondered if he knew the theme of the evening was humor at all. And as the speech went on and as he could tell he was dying up there and the red lights in his mind must have been flashing, he reached into his pocket and said, maybe this will help. And he pulled out an egg timer and got the one good laugh of the night. But the night was a disaster. It really was.
That was an argument, if there ever was one, for a presidential joke writer.
Okay, yes. I didn't put that in so many words, but I'm happy to hear you say it. I got back up to New York, and he admits, you know, that I felt, in even addition to the State of the Union address, to me, the alfalfa dinner that night was the missed opportunity for him from the point of view of humor and kind of, you know, taking your medicine and really not just taking your medicine, but it actually there's a lot of tactical advantage in self-directed humor. And he missed an opportunity to be the biggest person in that room that night and really missed an opportunity for what I hoped would be a shining moment for him. But the shining moment came a little later in the week when I got a note, a handwritten note from him that said, "Dear Mark, thanks for your help with the alfalfa dinner. The egg timer was great. Best, Bill Clinton."
Mark Katz is the author of Clinton and Me, a real-life political comedy. He talked with Jim Fleming. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Doug Gordon produced today's show, with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, Raymond Tangakar, and Craig Ely. Our theme music is by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.